All rise. State of Washington Court of Appeals, Division 1, is now in session. The Honorable James R. Burrell is presiding.
Morning. Please be seated.
Morning.
First case is Savchuk versus Sims.
May it please the court, my name is Jim Britton, and I represent the petitioner in this matter, Sergei Savchuk, and I would like to reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal. This case arises out of an agreement for the purchase and sale of real estate in Ferndale. It was the sellers were named the Dirties, and my client was the buyer. The agreement called for a purchase price of $725,000, $20,000 was an earnest money deposit. Those two parts of the purchase and sale agreement are clear. The rest is kind of a crazy quilt of ambiguity and conflicts. It called for, at one point, on one of the addenda, a partial payment of the purchase price by a note and deed of trust with a closing date of August of 2007. And a statement of certain interim payments that were to be made. If you totaled them, it was $230,000. There's another addendum that states that the purchase price was to be by note and deed of trust, that the note and deed of trust needed to be attached, but it was never attached. The only reference to any part of that being non-refundable in this initial purchase and sale agreement would be in the so-called safe harbor provision. And that's the provision, which is a common provision in purchase and sale agreements, where there's an option to check it off, and if it is checked off, then the seller says that they are limiting their remedies to retention of the, in this case, $20,000 earnest money payment. My client made payments mostly on schedule of the installments, fell a little behind, and as of August of 2007, when it was to originally have closed, could not obtain financing. At that point, the Jurdies, through their agent Ann Inman, put together an extension at my client, who had relied on Ms. Sams, the realtor, for a number of years for real estate transactions, could not reach Ms. Sams because she was away in Europe. He finally reached her at the last minute. And she said, you can rely on the opponent's agent, and you can trust the opponent's agent, and that's what he did.
Wasn't the representation, we'll treat you fairly?
Yes, we'll treat you fairly, exactly.
So what duties does that cause to arise?
Excuse me?
What duties does that cause to arise for Ms. Sams?
Many of the duties that we have alleged, for example, it's negligence under the Ms. Sams was one of the authors of the purchase and sale agreement.
All right. Let's assume for the moment that we think the deal got put together and there was no continuing duty. So now there's a call that says, "Hey, we got a problem. I can't fulfill the contract. We're talking about an extension. What do you think? I'm out of the country. I can't do anything. You should talk to their agent." What independent duties arise out of that conversation? Because that's the only conversation that's alleged.
First of all, I'd obviously take issue with the conclusion.
I understand that, but that'd be a waste of your time.
Okay.
Because it's a hypothetical.
Yes, minimum. Okay. All right. under the...
Is that enough to sustain an independent claim of negligence, and if so, why?
The breach of fiduciary duty extends beyond the purchase and sale agreement, according to Borchard, the Supreme Court version of Borchard, and Harstead versus Frohl. So at least there'd be a breach of fiduciary duty.
Based on the prior relationship, what did this conversation? If this was the only conversation they had, if he had this. He'd been in the contract. She hadn't put it together. He called her and said, "Geez, you know, this is falling apart. They've talked about an extension. Will you help me?"
And she said, her statement at that point would constitute a conflict of interest that's not disclosed under the statutory standards. Because
I assume that's by virtue of the commission agreement being paid.
That would be a part of it. That would be a part of it. But the she certainly continued to assume duty. She said, she just didn't say, I'm out of it. She said affirmatively, go trust the opposing agent. That created a breach of fiduciary duty, a conflict, and a breach of the duty of loyalty. She can't just, if she had said nothing, maybe it would be a different story. And, of course, our position is that the duty extended to that point anyway, and it's not limited by the purchase and sale agreement. At any rate,
But for the extension agreement, what harm did your client suffer? Doesn't it all tie back to the extension agreement?
No.
Why not?
Because the purchase and sale agreement itself was a mess. And if it had been properly drafted, for example, according to the declaration of Mr. Doggart, it would have closed under the normal circumstances where the note and deed of trust would have been given and Mr. Savchuk would have had the real estate, which is a far different position than he ended up being. He would have had the real estate. He would have income from the real estate. He could have sold the real estate. He would be in a far different position, and he wouldn't have given away $500,000 or $480,000.
But no matter what the original contract said, if he entered into this extension agreement, he'd be in the same boat he's in now, right?
If he entered into it, yes. The point is, he should have been given advice that kept him from ever getting to that point.
But it was clear that there was a clear schedule of payments, a clear interest rate, a clear total amount due, a clear closing date, a provision that no statutory warranty deed was to transfer until closing. All the payments were scheduled to be made before closing. Even if he'd given a note that matched those terms, he couldn't have given a deed of trust back because he wouldn't have had the statutory warranty deed. Because he wouldn't have made the payments and he wouldn't have closed.
All of the payments, even under the extension, were not included in the installments. There would still be $225,000.
But the point is, until all of the payments had been made, the closing couldn't occur. Until the closing occurred, the contract didn't trigger the statutory warranty deed. If he wasn't given the statutory warranty deed, he had no title to give back in a deed of trust. So anyone reading the contract would have understood that you couldn't have done a note and deed of trust consistent with the actual
specific term. Well, if you get to that point, but there are many points before that where he should have been provided with proper services. He should have never had the contract has an ambiguity even as to the amount that's due. It never really specifies whether the interim payments in the first deal are non-refundable or refundable. He could have insisted on the safe harbor provision and only been in the hole for $20,000 as opposed to $500,000. We maintain that the judgment should be reversed.
It pleases the court. Doug Tingvall representing the respondents, Christine Sams and Remax Metro Realty. Mr. Britton's argument basically boils down to this can't be the law. He doesn't cite any legal authority that supports his position, but this just can't be the law, that a broker's duties cease when the purchase and sale agreement is entered into and all contingencies are satisfied or waived. That's the clear law under Langston versus Huffacker, under Pilling, which is the most case on point because it discusses Kogan. The Kogan case, recall, was the one where there was a no-deal, no-commission clause in the agreement, and the Pilling court, this court, decided that that's the distinguishing factor. Likewise, in the later court of Ward versus Cowell Banker, San Juan Island Properties, same thing occurred. There was a financing contingency in the purchase and sale agreement that wasn't waived until the closing occurred. And so the duties of the broker continued until the financing was waived. Now, this is very simple, actually. There was a purchase and sale agreement entered into in fall of 2007. That agreement contained a feasibility study contingency like most builder land contracts do. Mr. Savchuk jump shipped under the basis of that feasibility study, renegotiated the price, and the parties entered into a new agreement in January of 2007. January 2007, the new agreement. Now, that's the agreement, which for purposes of this appeal, when we have to take all the evidence in light most favorable to non-moving party, let's assume it was a mess. And that issue has already come before this court. And this court, in the dispute between SaveCheck and Jerde, and this court ruled that even if there was ambiguity or inconsistency in the original 2007 purchase and sale agreement, whatever ambiguity existed was cured in August of 2007 when the addendum was entered into that clearly set forth a schedule of payments, said they were non-refundable, using that word, non-refundable, and said that, the balance of the purchase price was payable in cash at closing in May of 2008. That was the deal. No mention of a deed of trust in that addendum at all. So if Sam's was negligent in preparing the January and her role in preparing the January 2007...
There is a mention, isn't there? Oh, that's not addendum 34. You're talking about the extension agreement.
Talking about the extension. Yeah. The original purchase and sale agreement admittedly was a mess.
You suggested that he exercised the feasibility option to renegotiate. Is it clear from the record that he initiated the change or the need for an extension? And if so, does that have any significance to the outcome?
The renegotiation in January or the August 2007 addendum? Which are you referring to?
The extension agreement. When he opted the feasibility, when he used, you said
three steps. I think you got two. There's three steps. There's a purchase and sale agreement signed around in fall of 2007. A couple months later, he backed out on the feasibility study as he had the right to do. Right. Then renegotiated agreement, put a new agreement together in January 2007. That deal was the mess. Then in August of 2007, 8 months later, that's when the closing was supposed to occur, but didn't, and that's when the addendum was entered into.
Okay.
Now, so we got a very simple situation here. We could go through a 2 or 3 day trial on this case, and the issue would still boil down to the same thing, and that is, did the duties of Ms. Sams end in January of 2007 when that purchase and sale agreement was entered into, such that even if we take the evidence in a light most favorable to Mr. Safecheck, who said he called Christine Sams when she was in Europe, which is a disputed fact, but not for purposes of this hearing. So let's assume that he called her and said that he needed this extension because he couldn't get the financing together. See, she left the country thinking the deal was going to close while she was gone. She wasn't aware of any potential glitches or problems. And so if he called her, and there is a version of the facts, he simply said that she will treat you fairly. Well, does that trigger some duty to rush back from Europe and review the addendum or have it sent to her somehow and review it? No. Mr. Safecheck knows that if there's any questions about legal aspects, he should call his attorney, as he had done on previous transactions involving Ms. Sams. But the addendum doesn't contain any legal issues. So I would argue that wasn't even necessary. A person of average intelligence, Mr. Safecheck, being a sophisticated developer and builder, certainly is a person of at least average intelligence. Reading the addendum, the one in August of 2007, can clearly see that you have a payment schedule set forth, you have interest rates set forth, and you have a cash at closing with a specified closing date. There's nothing ambiguous about that addendum. So any negligence that existed in connection with the previous purchase and sale agreement was superseded by the August 2007 addendum. There's no proximate causal connection between whatever negligence occurred in the original purchase and sale agreement and what ultimately happened. Now, she doesn't have a duty to give him legal advice anyway. It's undisputed, however, that she didn't prepare the August addendum. She didn't see the August addendum until she got back from vacation after the fact, after it was already signed, and she didn't give him any advice about the addendum. Now, had she given him advice about it, she would have had a duty, it would have been a revived duty, to exercise reasonable care and skill in so doing, in giving advice, even though her duties as an agent had terminated when the purchase and sale agreement entered into. The rule is that the duties end when the purchase and sale agreement is entered into and all contingencies are satisfied or waived. There were no contingencies in the January deal because the fall contingency feasibility had already been waived as part of the January agreement. That's the rule. However, if the broker acts after the duties are fulfilled, then of course that triggers a duty to do so, exercising reasonable skill and care. And the only evidence before this court, taking the evidence in light most favorable to Mr. Safecheck, is that she said, talk to Ann, she'll treat you fairly. Now, the short answer to that is she did treat him fairly. There's nothing in that addendum that is unfair or unclear. He's a sophisticated buyer. He can read it. It's economic terms, not legal terms, as to when he makes the payments and how much is due and when it's due. Those things are crystal clear and don't require expert to look at it, an attorney to look at it. So The short answer is that whatever negligence occurred before the purchase and sale agreement, at or before the time of the January 2007 purchase and sale agreement, was not the proximate cause of whatever damage he now claims to have suffered. The August addendum was crystal clear. Whatever ambiguity existed was clarified in the August addendum. It sets forth economic terms, not legal terms, to which he agreed. Now, all this talk about the safe harbor provision and whatnot, the safe harbor clause is optional. It's not mandatory. Then Representative Applewick was the co-sponsor of that bill, in fact, back in 1990 when we got that enacted. I was the principal drafter of that. That particular safe harbor statute simply says if the agreement contains the magic language, then up to 5% of the purchase price can be forfeited without any inquiry about seller's actual damages. But if you're not in the safe harbor, either because the magic language isn't in the agreement or because the amount exceeds 5% of the purchase price, then you're back to the old common law test, which is it a reasonable forecast? And that's the issue this court addressed on the last appeal between Jared A. and SafeCheck. It was it a reasonable estimate of the damages the seller is likely to suffer in the event of a default, and therefore is it reasonable liquidated damages? That's not before the court today. What's before the court today is a claim of negligence against the agent. And there is no, even taking the evidence in light most favorable to Mr. SafeCheck, there is no evidence from which a judge or jury could find that Ms. Sams breached any existing duty that was owed to Mr. SafeCheck. Thank you.
What about the non-refundable commissions argument? In essence, I think he's arguing because she was accepting commissions on these payments under the original note and because the extension made any payments non-refundable, that it was in her interest to extend this contract and, say, work with the other broker.
Well, that's backwards, for one thing. The logic itself is backwards in the sense that in the usual transaction, when the broker's paid, when the deal closes, one would think that would be the type of transaction when the broker would have a potential economic conflict of interest to urge their client to close even if it wasn't in their interest. Here, the bulk of the commission had been paid already out of the non-refundable payments the SafeCheck made to Charity. So that removed from the usual case whatever conflict might have existed. Besides that, she didn't advise him about the addendum. She didn't see the addendum. She didn't know its terms. All Mr. SafeCheck claims is that she told him to talk to Ann. She'll treat you fairly. That's it. Now, as to the...
Now, you mentioned, you said the payments had already been made were non-refundable, but under the original agreement and schedule under Addendum 34, I didn't see any language that made those payments non-refundable. And I'm curious because I didn't see in the record instructions to the escrow agent to make payments on those progress payments out of escrow.
Well, those instructions were there, but they were issued by Jared A. Because Jared A. was paying the commission, not Mr. SafeCheck. And so Jared A. gave instructions to the closing agent to disperse the percentages of commission as and when payments were received by SafeCheck. I would argue, number one, it doesn't create a conflict of interest. To the contrary, the usual transaction has inherent a greater conflict of interest than this kind of transaction. And number two, since the commission had already been earned in January when the agreement was entered into, and all of the payments were made after January was entered in, after that January agreement, that the commission had already been earned. And although usually it's payable at closing, it's earned when the agreement's entered into. That's what Pilling and Langston versus Huffaker support. It's earned at this point, payable at that point. Since all the payments were made, whether they're non-refundable or not, all payments were made after January, then the commission had already been earned. And there's nothing improper about an agreement between the seller and the brokers to disperse. And the agreement was with the listing broker, who in turn was obligated to pay its share to the selling broker. Thank you.
Thank you. You get 2 minutes.
The standard is not that there is a categorical rule in the state of Washington that the realtor's duties are limited and expire with the purchase and sale agreement. The cases make pretty clear that it's a matter of contract. That's what the Kogan case is about. That's what the Ward case is about. That's what the Langston case is about. Certainly, if you put that together with Borchard and Frohl, those cases all establish that. In fact, there are no cases, interestingly enough, where any buyer's agent has had a limitation, and it's not by accident because buyers don't enter into listing agreements, so there is no contractual limitation. There should be no limitation in this case. It should be a matter of contract. That is supported by RCW 18.86070, which sets forth basically the terms of the scope of the agency as a function of contract. In this case, there was no written contract. There was a long course of dealing which indicated she was going to take care of him, which she certainly did not do, but there was no contract. The main point is, had she done what she should have done based on her standards of care as under the attorney standard or the realtor standard, he would have never been in that fix.
But what should she have done?
She should have not had the ambiguities in the contract. She should have made sure there was a note in deed of trust. It should have been structured in the normal way. It should have been structured such that the deed passed and a deed of trust and note was given. That wasn't done. Instead, he was left to hang out to make all of these payments, which were ambiguous as to the nature of them. She also knew, based on her own testimony, the nature of the safe harbor provision, and she never told him because she was receiving these secret commissions, which is what makes the conflict of interest.
Thank you. Next up is Myrie versus Galvin.